The Guardian.
It's becoming increasingly clear that the internet is dominated by a few key, rich and powerful players, to the detriment of our privacy, our concept of trust, and even our democracy.
These corporations are not politically neutral. They have needs. When I spoke with Eric Schmidt, he told me, you know, every day I wake up and I fight regulation. It's what I do. It's my job. So they are not apolitical. As Melvin Kranzberg says, technology is neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral. It's who owns and controls this technology. That's what will determine whether we live in a feudal system in the future or a democratic system.
Content in our system. We don't check what people say before they say it, and frankly, I don't think society should want us to. Freedom means you don't have to ask for permission first, and that by default, you can say what you want. And if you break our community standards or you break the law, then you're going to face consequences afterwards.
I'm Jordan Erica Weber, and in this series, we're looking at internet-enabled dystopia and how even technology designed to do good can end up causing harm. In the first episode, we talked about the threat to privacy posed by the business models of companies who harvest our data so that they and others can use it to make money.
We don't see it, we can't control it.
Then we explored the changing face of trust, how the sharing economy has led us to trust individuals instead of institutions, and how the opaque algorithms that determine who we can trust could be used against us.
Trust, undermining trust that takes almost nothing.
And then we turn to democracy, learning how data companies can provide those who wish to sway elections and referendums with the ability to target individual voters in the privacy of their Facebook feeds. The common thread in these discussions is rich and powerful people, companies, and even governments harvesting information from us and using opaque algorithms to allow them to make decisions about us, predict our behavior, and micro-target us with adverts for goods and services or even political ideologies. For this final episode, we're going to explore what ordinary citizens can do to take back control.
We don't have to go for the perfect solution of decentralized, free and open, interoperable solutions. We need to invest in those longer term. But in the midterm, we can be very pragmatic and support these companies that make products, that sell products, not people.
That's Aral Balkan, the cyborg rights activist we spoke to about the threat that companies like Facebook and Google pose to our privacy.
And that's why they're investing.
He suggests that one way to counter this business model built on harvesting our data is to support alternatives instead.
Let's take Apple and Google. So Apple makes their money by selling you products. When you buy an iPhone, Tim Cook is happy at that point. Now, you can take that iPhone and you can throw it out the window and you never use it, you never turn it on. It's okay. Tim Cook's still happy. He's made his profit. He made it the moment you bought that phone. Now, let's take a look at Google. If you buy an Android phone, and you never turn it on and you throw it in the trash, Google hates you because they've made almost no money on that, right? They start making money when you turn it on, you start using it, and this phone starts farming you for your information, for your data, right? And then they start building the insight that they have about you, which then they monetize. That's how they make their money. So we're talking about two multi-billion dollar companies, you know, fierce competitors, but with completely different business models. So Apple can provide privacy without breaking a sweat, and it's a feature that people want. And that's why they're investing so much time and effort and money into doing things like providing machine learning, but on the device itself, where you're getting smarter about yourself, Apple isn't getting smarter about you.
The legal face-off between the CEO of Apple and the director of the FBI is being judged in the court of a public opinion over a real judge's order demanding Apple help the FBI unlock an iPhone used by one of the San Bernardino attackers.
It's an economic advantage. We're talking about an absolute competitive advantage here, which is not something corporations get very often. So it's something that Apple can compete on, can provide, but it would make Google go bankrupt if they tried to provide it.
The two generals are now engaging each other directly in the impassioned battle over security versus privacy raging in cyberspace.
Gus Hussain, the executive director of Privacy International, also seems optimistic about Apple.
Fundamentally, the smartphone is still the best opportunity we have to change the computing model away from this highly centralized model we've created, which is almost reminiscent of the 1960s when you had like maybe 10 computers in the world. We were all just using those 10 computers. We've somehow returned to that. The smartphone that introduces more and more computing power in your hands can reverse that by saying, no, I'm going to do the processing here in my hand rather than send all my data upwards. The challenge is the Googles and the Facebooks of the world want to ensure your data travels upwards. For them, that's how they make their money. They're not search companies and they're not social networking companies. They are the world's largest advertising companies, and that advertising relies on your data. So it's not in their interest to give you choices or to give you control over what data is residing within their sphere. One of the innovations we saw with the latest iPhone, the iPhone X, and the iPhone X has many problems, and iOS, the operating system, has many problems. Apple still has its issues. But what was really interesting about the hardware they put into the phone is that their latest chip was designed to allow artificial intelligence processing to be kept on the device. So rather than, in order to use AI, having to send all your data to Apple or having to send all your data to Google, Apple said, well, we can do that processing locally. And that probably works better for you if you're in an environment where you don't have a connection, which is often for people. That is an interesting step forward that I think we're going to see more of.
This notion of doing processing locally rather than sending data to a central authority is a kind of decentralization, something several of the people we spoke to mentioned. Balkan, for instance, praised Mastodon, which is a decentralized open source social network that works a lot like Twitter. Balkan hopes that by supporting companies that, as he puts it, sell products rather than people, we can work our way towards a more socialist future.
So how do we get from where we are to where we want to be? It's a bridge. You know, as with any bridge, we need to be certain about two things. You know, where we are right now, where one leg of that bridge is going to be, which is right now, you know, we are in surveillance capitalism, and that's where one leg is.
Surveillance capitalism being a term popularized by Shoshana Zuboff, meaning a system by which companies monetize data acquired through surveillance.
And where we want the other leg to be, and that is a decentralized, free and open, interoperable future that's funded from the commons, right? And again, remember, we can't fix surveillance capitalism by just fixing surveillance. We need to fix capitalism as well. So we're talking about a socialistic system here. Let's say that one leg is in surveillance capitalism, the other leg, let's call it techno-socialism. We need to build that bridge between them. This is where stopgaps are very important. This is where companies today that sell products, not people, you know, supporting that is very important. But we need to start weaving the fabric of a system that's supported from the commons. The European Union actually supporting startup-style projects, but are not startups, because startup is a Silicon Valley brand, right? It's venture capital funded. Instead of startups, how about we start supporting stay-ups, which use what works from Silicon Valley? We can work in small teams, use lean processes, iterate quickly, you know, fail quickly and learn from our mistakes, have multiple of these working and competing against each other, but supported, funded from the commons, and with the goal of building free and open, interoperable, decentralized systems. So we can start doing this today and incentivizing this bridge between, you know, where we are and where we want to be.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll look at how our experts think we can begin to take back control.
Really basic things like you can turn this off, right? Like it's not always listening and watching and tracking you.
I don't think we're going to be able to stop people from trying to influence each other. That's part of what it means to be in a civilization, is that you try to change people's minds.
Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's Hear as in hearing and Hear as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
Welcome back to Chips with Everything. I'm Jordan Erica Weber. Of the people we spoke to for this series, the biggest proponent for willingly giving up information in order to get something in return was Kevin Kelly.
What we have discovered...
The founding executive editor of Wired magazine and author of a book called The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future.
The shock that we didn't know about ourselves as a species is that when we have that choice to move the slider to maximum obscurity and minimum personalization, which is what some people call privacy, but I think it's something different, to the other extreme, which is maximum transparency and maximum personalization, that when we give people a chance to move that slider, in most cases, people are pushing it way to the personalization. And I call that vanity trumps privacy. In general, people are choosing to reveal themselves because it's about them.
Importantly, Kelly is interested in what he gets in return for allowing information about him to be gathered. And if there's not enough benefit for him, he calls that an asymmetry in his relationship with these organizations.
So the problem with governments doing things...
Here's where he sees a problem when the organization behind the collection or use of data is a government.
They're usually not very transparent about it, and they usually give you no benefit. So I would say, just in general, if there's information being accumulated about us, about a person, about me, about you, to make that symmetrical... First of all, I need to know everything about you. It has to be completely transparent. I need to know who you are, what you're doing with it, how you're storing it, how you're getting benefit from it. I need to be able to correct it if it's incorrect. I need to be able to have some say in it. And most importantly, I need to have direct benefit from it. Because if I'm not getting direct benefit from it, from me personally, then it's not symmetrical. And so I think part of the issue with some of the things where governments are doing is that it's completely asymmetrical. So it's not that they're collecting the information or using it to try and sway. It's that it's an asymmetrical relationship. And so they're probably not being transparent about it. There's no accountability. And the people whose information is involved aren't themselves getting any benefit from it. So if we can restore those things, then I think we're going to feel a lot better about it. What we want to do is we want to be aware that that's happening, that if there's a message coming or an ad coming, we want to know what the source is. We want to be able to identify what the source is. Who paid for that? Where is that money coming from?
We're increasing our investment in security and specifically in election integrity. In the next year, we will more than double the team working on election integrity. In total, we'll add more than 250 people across all of our teams focused on the security and safety of our community.
Right now, there's asymmetry because these messages are coming. We don't know where they're coming from. We don't know who they are. We don't know who funds them. I have no control over it. It's not transparent. So it's asymmetrical, but I think if we can bring some symmetry to it, so here's what's going on. Here's who's paying for those ads. Here's what those ads say, because right now we can't even see the ads. They're being hidden because they're just going to one person. And I'm going to get some benefit from that as an individual. If someone's helping me think about something or I'm hearing another view, I think that's a benefit. But I want to know who they are. That's what's missing. I don't think we're going to be able to stop people from trying to influence each other. That's part of what it means to be in a civilization, is that you try to change people's minds. That's fine. But let's do it in a way that it has much more transparency in it.
One issue with the notion of increasing the transparency of what these companies do with our data, which came up again and again throughout the conversations we had for this series, is the algorithms used. Can you really have transparency when you don't understand the technology being used to make decisions about you? Rachel Botsman, an expert on trust, expresses these concerns when talking about whether we can trust an algorithm.
The way we assess trust is based on whether someone or something is trustworthy. And there is a real science behind this that we really see. It comes down to four traits. Competence. Is this thing or person, is it capable of doing what it says it can do? Reliability, which is really how dependable and responsive it is. And I think on those two traits, we actually make the same assessment whether it is an artificially intelligent machine or whether it is a real human being. And that's really the how side of the equation, the competence side of the equation of trust. Where it differs is on the why side of the equation, so why someone is doing something. And that really comes down to benevolence, how much does this person care, and their integrity, which is not whether they're a good person, but much more about their intentions and whether their intentions are aligned with yours or mine. And that why side of the equation is really hard to even get right when you're assessing a human being. Like, you rely on all kinds of different signals and context and information from all these different sources. So when that bot or that AI algorithm is invisible, understanding how it cares and what its intentions really are, they're kept hidden.
Algorithms are pervasive. They control every aspect of the internet.
So that is really tricky when it comes to assessing whether it's trustworthy or whether it's not.
The way your child gets assigned to a school, probably an algorithm at work.
In that episode, on the changing face of trust, both Botsman and Luciano Floridi, who is Professor of Philosophy and Ethics of Information at the University of Oxford, agreed that we need to make sure we stay in control of this technology.
It would be very risky if we were to delegate any process entirely 100% to an automatic system without the remotest possible way of controlling or rectifying its operations. My impression is that we will trust increasingly the technologies we are building, insofar as we can also show that perhaps there is a lack of transparency, but a very high degree of control of those technologies.
So here's where we start talking about regulation. We'll get to regulation by law in a minute, but the notion of being able to switch off the tech, like a dishwasher, is a different kind of regulation, baked right in.
I just don't think traditional regulation is the right kind of approach, that you can't apply like top-down compliance to these systems that just are innately different. You know, I really think it's a bit like the immune system, right? That the solutions have to be embedded in the system itself.
But here we are once again, gentlemen, with a different idea of regulation in capitalism. There's a different chemistry in Europe than there is in the United Kingdom, Adrian, as there is in the United States. It's obviously anti-capitalist, but is it anti-innovation and disruption as well?
People ask me, should they have like a seal on them where, you know, they've met some kind of ethical AI standards like fair trade coffee? And I think that is a start. Like, I think there's a start in really basic things, like you can turn this off, right? Like, it's not always listening and watching and tracking you. You have the power to delete your data. Your data and your movements and the information that you're sharing will not be sold on or commercialized without your permission. So I do think there are baseline promises that we could offer to consumers and to parents that would be a good starting place.
And also into the fabric of these companies.
I was at a conference recently and there were 6,000 CIOs there, chief information officers and security officers. And I asked them how many of them had digital ethics as part of their job or even part of the conversation so that the technology could do something, but should it do something? And about 6 people raised their hands. And then I asked them, well, how many of you have data and security teams and have, you know, focused on privacy breaches? And the entire audience raised their hand. And that wouldn't have been the case like a decade ago. But I think time isn't on our side here. And so digital ethics needs to become part of the corporate fabric. And it can't be just sort of a side unit. It really needs to be at the board level. And that we actually need ethical frameworks for thinking through these decisions.
but legislation is crucial. And this is what journalist Carol Cadwallader and lawyer Ravi Naik have been looking into. We spoke to both of them for our episode on the threat to democracy, in which we talked about Cadwallader's investigation of data company Cambridge Analytica.
There is a knowability about that we have laws and were they broken?
Electoral law requires some reform to cope with the potential for data-driven micro-targeted advertising hidden in the privacy of individual Facebook feeds, put in place by whoever has the cash to pay for it. But those aren't the only laws that are struggling to keep up with the pace of technological change. Lawyer Ravi Naik explained to us the current state of data protection laws and how the European Union is working to improve them.
Our data protection framework derives from the 80s. It's a very old framework. It works as a charter of data rights, if you will. That framework was developed when the internet wasn't even a thing. Because of that, the European Union has developed a new framework. Particularly, this framework was developed in response to the Snowden revelations. How do you protect people's rights in the digital age?
The new framework is known as the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation.
One good example is profiling. Profiling is dealt with around the edges of the Data Protection Act, but becomes a real central focus within the new GDPR. If you are profiled, you'd have rights against that profiling. That exists in a way that doesn't exist within the Data Protection Act.
The GDPR comes from the EU, but while we're still a member state, we have to incorporate it. Though Naik isn't sure our proposed incorporation is quite good enough.
Our bill, in my view, at present, falls slightly short of what's required by the GDPR. However, there are questions before Parliament about this, because the European Union requires for any data processing or transfer across between a member state and non-member states, which we may be, we have to have adequate data protection regulations, so-called adequacy requirements. So if our standards fall short of the GDPR, we will not be able to provide data to the European Union. That is the risk. I therefore understand that we are seeking to incorporate the GDPR to make sure we meet the adequacy requirements. However, the bill as currently framed has some shortfalls.
And there's still that pushback from the businesses who want to be able to continue harvesting and using people's data without so many restrictions.
We have huge challenges in order to be able to regulate effectively.
Harold Balkan, our cyborg rights activist, says this reflects a general state of institutional corruption.
One of the most important of which is lobbying, corporate lobbying. So companies like Google, whereas maybe 5 years ago weren't even lobbying, today Google is the top lobbyer of the European Commission. So they're spending millions and millions to influence public policymakers. And it's not just lobbying. We have revolving doors. So today I might be working at the European Commission where, you know, my task is to protect the rights of European citizens, let's say. That's what it should be. And maybe in 2 years' time, I'm working at the corporations that I'm supposed to be protecting these citizens from, the corporations that I'm supposed to be regulating. So maybe I'm regulating Google at the European Commission today. 2 years' time, I'm working at Google.
Today, the Commission has decided to fine Google 2.4 billion euros for breaching EU antitrust rules.
We have co-regulations, so saying to Google, hey, come to the table, Google, tell us, how should we regulate you? And Google's like, we have a couple of ideas about how we should be regulated on privacy. Unless we can remove the influence of corporate finance in public policymaking, we're not going to be able to regulate effectively. And so it's actually quite surprising, positively surprising for me to see legislation like the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, coming into effect, and the e-privacy regulation that's at the European Parliament right now. So despite this environment, we are seeing in Europe positive steps.
Gus Hussain, the Executive Director of Privacy International, says the businesses that have tried to amend this new general data protection regulation haven't had as much influence as they would have liked.
Industry fought really hard against the creation of a new law, where industry introduced 3,000 amendments. It was the most attempted amended piece of legislation in European history. Industry did not succeed as often as it had hoped. So there's a relatively strong legal regime coming out of Europe right now. And the United Kingdom, there's a data protection bill which implements much of this in law. So in a sense, we'll have greater capability to have control over our data, but a lot of it will rely on understanding. It'll rely on us knowing that we have these rights, knowing that when a company says, I'm sorry, we don't have that data, you have the right to demand further. And that's why you need NGOs and other organizations and consumer groups to get active in using this law to force these companies to be transparent. They're afraid of this law. So in that sense, we've never had a better moment to protect our privacy. But the law is only as good as the capabilities of people to use it, but also the enforcement of the law. Unless our regulators can ensure that the Googles and the Facebooks are transparent, that it can ensure that the government agencies using technologies at least tell us that they're using these technologies, but also explain to us how it's lawful, only then will it have true meaning. And so while at one moment we are getting ever more rights to protect ourselves against ever greater risks, we have powerful entities who are just proceeding as if nothing should ever interfere with their God-given right to collect as much data as they can, do as they please, and not be held to account. So we have one hell of a fight on our hands for the next decade.
The more consumers click on comparison shopping results, the more money Google makes.
Citizen activism is the way all of our rights have importance. For rights to mean anything, for rights to be effective, they have to be practical, and rights are only practical as far as people seek to enforce them, as far as people seek to stand by them. If rights are abstract, not used, they mean nothing. If rights are stood behind, if people try to stand up for their own rights, rights will then develop. Now, if you look at the early civil rights movement, those rights that the civil rights activists stood behind existed within the Constitution. That was a framework that developed because people stood up for what they believed in and stood up for rights that already existed, made rights effective and practical. Here in the data protection sphere, we see the same thing. The data protection regulations have existed for many years before the advent of modern technology as we know it. But because technology has become so ingrained, so important to everything we do, there's a growing awareness that actually you have rights over the way that data is being used. Through those steps, people are taking challenges and starting to set the parameters about what is and what is not permissible around the use of their data. So the story that emerges from all these new cases that we're seeing, and particularly the cases that I'm involved in, is that the rights that we're trying to assert for people only have power because people are seeking to instruct us to enforce those rights. As people seek to enforce their rights and get control over their data, parameters are set, companies are made to respect individual rights, and we can have a shared internet space that's more rights-focused than it currently is.
Many of the people we spoke to for this series agreed that we need some kind of citizen activism in order to tackle this issue. Even Kevin Kelly, who is perhaps more pragmatic about the use of his data, said that consumer demand is fundamental.
Unless citizens and consumers demand it, it's not going to happen. So there has to be that kind of demand. And then there's the question, well, then how do we enforce it? And then I think there's going to be legislation and other means of social expectations and social etiquette to enforce this. But I think first of all, there has to be the demand for it, where people have to ask the question, what happens with this stuff? You're getting some value. Tell me about my benefit.
We need more public pressure. We need more political pressure. We need the platforms to step up and realise the fact that they aren't the force for good, that there's been this very sort of naive idea of just more technology is more progress, is better for everybody, and we're going to move into this wonderful network future and it's all going to be great. And, you know, it's very slowly, it's like, well, actually, there are some downsides and you actually need some other types of people thinking about this, not just technologists. That's one of the things that I increasingly think is you need philosophers and you need psychologists and you need politicians and you need all sorts of different people thinking about those, you know, really fundamentally issues.
Different people we spoke to had different levels of optimism about the extent to which citizens are going to act. Still, at the end of this conversation about technology-enabled dystopia, it's Hussein who has a word of hope for the future. And it lies with young people.
It's become so common to presume that young people who grew up in the Facebook era just don't care and that they'll be essentially robots in 10 to 15 years' time. And it's really the older generation that is caught in this conservative idea that we should be in control. The reality is that the data is actually upside down. The studies of how younger people use technology is that they're much more sophisticated, they're much more aware, and they're much more capable of protecting themselves. We're fundamentally using the exact same technologies we've used in the past 15 years. Innovation has actually not continued at the same pace as it was, say, 15 years ago. So what gives me hope is that the current generation of young people will, when they're 30, when they're 40, when they're 50, they will be savvy, they will be demanding, and they will be expecting innovation that gives them power. The whole idea that young people nowadays use Facebook and use Twitter and use all these other social media doesn't make them idiots. It makes them people who know how to be a teenager online. They're not professing everything and declaring everything to the outside world. They still have secrets. They still have interactions they want to keep away from their teachers, from their parents, from their peers. And so they become savvy at doing that. When they're 30, they'll be the voters. They will be the ones with the purchasing power, and industry will have to meet their needs and governments will have to meet their demands. That gives me optimism.
Over the course of this series, we've explored in depth the notion that we're living through an internet-enabled dystopia, looking at the loss of privacy, the changing face of trust, and the threat to democracy. But that information, however depressing, is important. It's only by keeping informed that we know how to act. And, as all the people we spoke to agreed, we can and should use the power we have to determine the shape the internet of the future will take. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.